Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Produced at the Recording Library of West Texas.
Hello, this is Michael, and I will be reading True West Magazine. It's the May-June 2024 edition. A Deadly Duel at 500 Yards by Bob Bozbell. Bass Reeves versus Jim Webb, the master of the long shot indeed. Based on the research of Art Burton. June 15, 1884. Out on the Whiskey Trail in Oklahoma Territory, Deputy U.S. Marshal Bass Reeves is hot on the trail of a murderer named Jim Webb, who the lawman had previously arrested and brought to justice in 1883. After a year in jail in Fort Smith, Webb got out on a $17,000 bond and skipped. Now Reeves got the word that Webb had drifted back into the Chickasaw Nation and was hiding out at Jim Bywater's general store on the south side of the Arbuckle Mountains. Riding with Reeves is Deputy John Cantrell, who Bath sends ahead to see if Webb is around. Sure enough, Cantrell spots Webb in the store and signals Reeves to come ahead. An eyewitness, D.C. Gideon, describes what happens next. As he went dashing up, Webb espied him, and jumping through the open window, armed with both revolver and Winchester, ran for his horse that stood about 100 yards away. Reeves cut him off from his horse, and Webb turned toward a clump of bushes, ran about 600 yards, turned, and fired. The first shot grazed the horn of Reeves' saddle. The second cut a button from his coat, and the third cut off both bridle reins below his hand, allowing them to fall to the ground. As Reeves jumped from his horse, another bullet cut the brim of his hat. Reeves then fired his first shot, and before Webb could fall, had sent two Winchester balls through his body. By this time, Reeves' posse and Messrs. Bywaters and Smith came running up. Webb lay on the ground with his revolver in his hand, calling Reeves to come to him. Reeves advanced, but while keeping his gun trained on him, told Webb to throw the revolver away. He flung it into the grass out of his reach, and the whole party walked up to the dying man. "Give me your hand, Bass," said Webb, as he extended his own with an effort to grasp it. "You are a brave man. I want you to accept my revolver and scabbard as a present, and you must accept them. Take it, for with it I have killed 11 men, 4 of them in Indian Territory, and I expected you to make the 12th. Bass accepted the present and has it now carefully stored away. The dying declaration of Webb was taken in writing by Mr. Bywaters, and thus ended the career of another bad man. The master of surprise and disguise. Bass Reeves preferred to arrest bad men by surprise to cut down the likelihood they might fire on him. According to Reeves' biographer, Art Burton, Bass did this in many different ways, from riding up on felons before they woke up in the morning, to using his many disguises and totally catching them off guard. Supposedly, one of Reeves's effective undercover disguises was to dress as a dirt poor farmer and pretend to be harmless, literally shuffling into an armed camp with his hands in his pockets. Bass invariably got the drop on his unsuspecting prey, sometimes more than one. With over 3,000 arrests to his credit, his achievements in using surprise and disguise are unparalleled and unmatched. Later in his career, Reeves trained many young deputies who worked in the Indian Territory. Aftermath, odds and ends. During Judge Parker's 20-year tenure on the bench in Fort Smith, some 75 to 100 deputies died in the line of duty. Bass Reeves made, on average, $400 a trip, and his biggest haul was bringing in 17 prisoners with a fee of $900. The U.S. Attorney General estimated that of the 20,000 whites living in the Indian Territory during the time Reeves was active, only 5,000 were law-abiding. Judge Parker, known as the Hanging Judge, actually hanged 30 whites, 26 Indians, and 23 blacks. While being interviewed by a newspaper in 1907, Reeves made the following remarks about the Webb shootout. "The bravest man I ever saw," said Reeves, "was Jack Jim Webb, a Mexican that I killed in 1884 near Sacred Heart Mission. He was a murderer. I got in between him and his horse. He stepped out into the open 500 yards away and commenced shooting with his Winchester. Before I could drop off my horse, his first bullet cut a button off my coat, and the second cut my bridle rein in two. I shifted my six-shooter and grabbed my Winchester and shot twice. He dropped, and when I picked him up, I found that my two bullets had struck within an inch, a half inch of each other. He shot four times, and every time he shot, he kept running closer to me. He was 500 yards away from me when I killed him." Recommended book: Black Gun, Silver Star, The Life and Legend of Frontier Marshal Bass Reeves by Art T. Burton. Bison Books, University of Nebraska Press. True West Magazine, May-June 2024 edition. Bass Reeves finally gets his due. Who was Bass Reeves? Historian Art Burton has spent much of his life on the trail of the elusive lawman's life. Reeves's life from slave to deputy U.S. Marshal, serving the Western District of Arkansas in the Indian and Oklahoma territories in the last decades of the 19th century, is extraordinary. But the truth about his life has not been published in detail until the last 30 years. Professor Burton's determination to chronicle the life of Deputy Reeves is comparable to the famed lawman's 32-year career in the U.S. Marshals. Since Burton's Black, Red, and Deadly, Black and Indian Gunfighters of the Indian Territory, 1870 to 1907, published in 1991, and his definitive biography of the Western hero, Black Gun, Silver Star, The Life and Legend of Frontier Marshal Bass Reeves, 2007, were published, Reeves' life and career have slowly gained the notoriety and honor they deserve, including through novelization and Hollywood dramatization. In 2021, True West's editors worked closely with Burton on the magazine's first in-depth cover story on the legendary life of Bass Reeves, including how Burton's favorite lawman had become a darling of film and television. 3 years later, with Lawman, Bass Reeves, a highly rated and well-publicized primetime series streaming on Paramount Plus, we have asked Burton to recount the extraordinary life of Bass Reeves, from his days as a slave to the most storied lawman to serve justice as a deputy U.S. Marshal for Judge Isaac Parker. Bass Reeves' timeline. 1838. Bass Reeves is born in Crawford County, Arkansas, as enslaved property of Arkansas politician farmer William Steele Reeves. 1846. Bass moves to Frontier, Texas with the William Steele Reeves family. 1850. Bass is assigned to the son of William Reeves, George, as a body servant, valet. George is elected sheriff of Grayson County, Texas. 1855. George Reeves is elected to the Texas House of Representatives for Grayson County. 1861. George Reeves is made second in command of the Confederate 11th Texas Cavalry Regiment. Bass accompanies George as his body servant, valet. The 11th Cavalry Regiment fights in the Indian Territory. 1862. Colonel George Reeves and the 11th Texas Cavalry Regiment fight at the Battle of Pea Ridge. Sometime after the battle, Bass and George have a fight over a card game, and Bass knocks George out and escapes into the Indian Territory. 1863 to 1865. Bass Reeves serves with the Union Army in the battles of Cabin Creek and Honey Springs, both Union victories. For the rest of the war, Reeves is involved in skirmishes and engagements as a Union irregular and scout in the Indian Territory. 1866 to 1870. Bass Reeves is engaged as a scout, interpreter, guide for railroad surveyors in the Indian Territory. 1870. Bass Reeves moves his family to Van Buren, Arkansas. Bass serves as a scout and guide for Deputy U.S. Marshals of the Federal Court at Van Buren. 1875, Federal Court moved to Fort Smith in 1871. Bass is given a commission as Deputy U.S. Marshal under Judge Isaac C. Parker. 1880, Reeves builds a new home inside the city limits of Van Buren. He is the first African American to build in the city. Most blacks live outside the town. 1883, Reeves arrests a ranch foreman named Jim Webb for the murder of a black preacher in the Chickasaw Nation. In making the arrest, Reeves must shoot and kill a Webb ally. 1884, Reeves goes after Jim Webb, who was bailed out and didn't appear for trial. Reeves and Webb have a gunfight in the Chickasaw Nation. Reeves kills Webb with a rifle shot at 500 yards at Bywater's store. 1884. Reeves accidentally shoots his cook, William Leach, and kills him. 1885. Bass requests the warrant for the arrest of Belle Starr for horse thief. Belle later turns herself in at Fort Smith, Arkansas. 1886. In January, Reeves is arrested for the shooting of his camp cook, relieved of duty, and incarcerated in the Fort Smith Federal Jail. In June, Reeves paves bail and is released. 1887, Bass stands trial for the murder of Leach. A jury finds him not guilty, and he resumes his job as a deputy U.S. Marshal. 1890, Reeves arrests a Seminole outlaw, Greenleaf, who has murdered 7 people, 3 whites and 4 Indians. Greenleaf has been on the run for 17 years. Reeves attacks and burns down the cabin of fugitive Cherokee outlaw Ned Christie, but Ned escapes. 1893, Reeves begins working for the Eastern District of Texas Federal Court in Paris. This court has jurisdiction over the Chickasaw and Choctaw nations. Base is stationed at Calvin, Choctaw Nation. 1896. Reeves goes undercover as Jim Underwood in Houston to get a confession from a murder suspect. After spending 3 months with the suspect, Reeves receives a signed confession. 1896. In March, Bass's wife, Jenny, dies in Fort Smith, Arkansas. 1897. Bass begins work for the Northern District of the Indian Territory, headquartered at Muscogee Creek Nation. Reeves is stationed at Wetkuma Creek Nation. 1898, Reeves is the lead investigator for the slayings of a black man and white woman living common law. The case is known as Wybark Tragedy. Reeves makes several arrests, but there are no grand jury indictments. 1900, Bass Reeves is remarried to a Chickasaw freedman named Winnie Sumter. Reeves moves to Muscogee and lives at 4th and Court Streets. 1903, Reeves arrests his son, Benny, for domestic murder in Muscogee. Benny is convicted and sent to Leavenworth Federal Prison. 1906, Bass escapes an assassination attempt on his life near Wybar Creek Nation on the Texas Road. 1907, Reeves is involved in the largest gunfight in Muscogee history that involves black anarchists called the United Socialist Club. 5 of the outlaws are killed, 2 wounded, and 4 surrendered. Bass killed one and wounded another. 1907, Bass arrests the minister that baptized him for selling bootleg whiskey. 1908, Bass Reeves becomes a member of the Muscogee Police Department at 68 years of age. He is given a beat in downtown Muscogee. Reeves brags, "There was never a crime on my beat." 1912, Bass Reeves dies of Bright's disease and complications in Muskogee, Oklahoma, on January 12th. He was 72 years old. By Art T. Burton. Bass Reeves, the greatest deputy U.S. Marshal. Recently, David Kennedy, historical curator of the U.S. Marshals Museum in Fort Smith, Arkansas, commented about Bass Reeves, most exemplary law enforcement officer the country has ever seen. Bass Reeves, the former enslaved African-American from Arkansas and Texas, reimagined himself and became one of the most legendary heroes in United States history. Reeves was not the first black deputy for the Western District of Arkansas Federal Court, and there were many who followed him for that court. But he became the most famous and outstanding, regardless of race, in carrying out his duty to uphold the law. The Western District of Arkansas had total jurisdiction over federal crimes in Western Arkansas and all the Indian Territory, pre-statehood Oklahoma. The area was very diverse with American Indians, European Americans, and African Americans. The five civilized tribes had a large population of black citizens due to the embrace of chattel slavery before and after their removal from the Southeast to the Indian Territory. After the war, these African Americans were known as Indian freedmen. Many of the black deputy U.S. Marshals for the Fort Smith Federal Court were Indian freedmen. Reeves was hired in 1875, and the first U.S. Marshal he worked under was Daniel Upham, former commander of the Arkansas State Militia that destroyed the Ku Klux Klan in Arkansas in the late 1860s. Reeves started after the arrival of Judge Isaac C. Parker and worked for the Fort Smith Court until 1893, when he transferred to the Eastern District of Texas Federal Court in Paris. Bass spent his last 10 years of federal service working for the U.S. Federal Court at Muskogee, Creek Nation, Indian Territory. He is the only deputy on record who started with Judge Parker in 1875 and worked until Oklahoma statehood in November of 1907. The Indian-Oklahoma territories were the most dangerous area in the 19th and early 20th centuries for deputy U.S. Marshals. Over 130 men lost their lives in these territories, according to the preeminent researcher of men killed in the line of duty for the U.S. Marshals Service, Robert Ernst. Bass Reeves walked into the Valley of Death every day for 30 years and didn't flinch. Reeves, as a black man, had to navigate the racial landscape, attitudes and perceptions of whites, blacks, and Indians of the territories, which was not always an easy feat. In 1901, Reeves was interviewed by a newspaper, and he stated he had arrested at that time over 3,000 men and women who had broken federal laws. This was still 6 years before his retirement from federal service. Reeves worked primarily in the Indian and Oklahoma territories, but while he was a deputy for the Eastern District of Texas Federal Court, he went on assignment as far south as Houston, Texas. He was a master of disguise, regularly masquerading as a cowboy, preacher, farmer, tramp, or outlaw to get near fugitives he was trying to capture. Reeves was very proud of his detective work. He was highly perceptive, had great observational skills, and used deductive reasoning before the fictional character known as Sherlock Holmes did. At Reeves's death, many newspapers reported that he had killed 14 men in the line of duty. More than a few newspapers stated he had killed more than 20 men in the line of duty. Being that Reeves was ambidextrous with pistol and rifle, and an expert with either weapon, he would have had to be considered one of the top gunfighters in Wild West history. I believe unequivocally that Bass Reeves was the greatest federal lawman of the Western frontier. Who was the real Bass Reeves? Bass Reeves was a Texas gentleman and treated everyone with dignity and respect. Reeves was 6'2", weighed 190 pounds. It was said he had near superhuman strength and he could whip any two men with his bare hands. Reeves was known to be gregarious, full of life, liked telling jokes and laughing. He was a master of disguise in his detective pursuits. Reeves mastered all weapons of combat and could shoot a pistol or rifle with either hand expertly. In a gunfight, he would always sing softly prior to the engagement. He was always very focused on catching the felons he was chasing. Bass got to know a multitude of residents and settlers, a pioneer in community policing. He loved dogs and horses and kept a large dog to guard his camp and watch the prisoners. Reeves always rode large horses, favoring sorrels and grays. A true man of the West. The discovery of Bass Reeves's attempted assassination site. Deputy U.S. Marshal Jeremy Hammonds of the Eastern District of Arkansas office in Little Rock, Arkansas, and Mike Higgs, assistant curator for the Secretary of State office at the Arkansas State Capitol, located the trestle that Bass Reeves rode under in November of 1906 when he was almost assassinated near Wybark, Creek Nation, Indian Territory. Reeves was fired on in the darkness as he drove his buggy under the trestle and returned fire, but didn't hit the culprit. Higgs took the initiative and started researching old railroad maps of the Missouri, Kansas, and Texas Railroad. He spoke to the curator of history for the Union Pacific Railroad that currently owns the tracks of the Fallen Flag MK&T Railroad line today. Higgs was able to ascertain that the trestle was on a spur line that ran from Muskogee to Tulsa in the Creek Nation, now Oklahoma. The trestle was built in 1902, 4 years before the Reeves incident. It was near a water spring and crossed over the old Texas Road. Deputy Hammonds was able to take the information and travel from Little Rock and find the exact location north of Muskogee. The Union Pacific Railroad still uses the spur track. The location is now on private property, but Hammonds was able to get permission for the search, which turned out successful. A good piece of detective work by Higgs and Hammonds. Bass Reeves and the media. The biggest recent news for Bass Reeves and popular media was the release in 2023 of Lawman Bass Reeves, an 8-part series produced by Taylor Sheridan and David Oyelowo, who also portrayed Reeves in the production on Paramount Plus. In 2021, Bass Reeves was portrayed in the BBC production of Around the World in 80 Days, shown on PBS in the United States. Reeves was played by British actor Gary Beadle. Reeves was also portrayed in the INSP Western Cable Channel series Wild West Chronicles in 2021 and 2023. On the literary scene, my book, Black Gun, Silver Star, The Life and Legend of Frontier Marshal Bass Reeves, came out with an enlarged, revised edition in September of 2022. This book has not been optioned for a movie or a television series yet. TCU literary professor Sidney Thompson's fictional trilogy on Bass Reeves was optioned for the Lawman Bass Reeves series. Thompson's books are Follow the Angels, Follow the Doves, 2020, Hell on the Border, 2021, and The Forsaken and the Dead, 2023. The first two books were used for the miniseries. Other noted fiction books on Bass Reeves include The Legend of Bass Reeves, being the true and fictional account of the most valiant marshal in the West by Gary Paulson, and Bad News for Outlaws by Vonda Nelson in 2009. A recent fiction book, Bass Reeves Versus by Ben L. Jones, published in 2023. These books were written for young readers. Two fiction books were written about Bass Reeves arresting his son, Legacy of a Lawman, a Western Story, by Johnny D. Boggs, 2013, and A Bass Reeves Adventure, Give Me the Warrant, by S.C. Sherman, 2023. The literary rights of my first book, Black, Red, and Deadly, Black and Indian Gunfighters of the Indian Territory, 1870 to 1907, with the largest chapter on Bass Reeves, was purchased by Morgan Freeman and his company, Revelations Entertainment Incorporated, and is currently not found a home as a movie or a streamer for a television series. In 2015, two docudramas were made about Bass Reeves for cable television. The first was from Fox Television, produced by Bill O'Reilly for his Legends and Lies Western series, titled Bass Reeves, the Real Long Ranger. Bass Reeves was portrayed by the actor D.L. Hopkins with on-screen remarks by me. The second docudrama was from the Discovery Channel for their series Gunslingers, second season, titled Bass Reeves, the Real Long Ranger. Bass was portrayed by actor Joseph Curtis Challenger, with on-screen remarks by True West Magazine executive and editor Bob Bozbell and me. Earlier in television, Bass Reeves was intelligently portrayed by actor Coleman Domingo and Deputy U.S. Marshal Grant Johnson in the NBC series Timeless and the fictional episode titled The Murder of Jesse James in 2017. In January 2020, there was an independent small-budget movie released titled Hell on the Border, filmed in Alabama, which starred David Gaisi as Bass Reeves as the lead character. The movie was not historically accurate and had a weak plot. Corsicana, another independent movie released in 2021, was shot in Texas and was directed by and stars Isaiah Washington as Bass Reeves, based on a fictional storyline. Netflix developed a fictional black western movie produced by Jay-Z, a 2021 release titled The Harder They Fall, which used the names of various African-American characters of the real western frontier. Some of the historic names portrayed in the movie were Stagecoach Mary, Nat Love, Rufus Buck, Jim Beckworth, and Cherokee Bill. The noted British film actor Delroy Lindo portrayed lawman Bass Reeves. This movie was very popular on Netflix, and they have been greenlit for a sequel. In documentary film, the French public television network, ART, produced a documentary titled Black Far West, also known as The Black West, A Counter History of the Wild West, which featured Bass Reeves. It was released in 2023. There is also a new documentary titled In Search of Bass Reeves, released in 2024 by Knox Robinson Films. Both films will be available to view on Amazon Prime Channel. How overlooked was Bass Reeves in mainstream popular culture until Art T. Burton began publishing on Reeves in 1991? From 1953 to 1979, Reeves was never mentioned in True West magazine. And what about in mainstream television, where the Western was king throughout the 1950s and 60s? The first black actor to appear in a Western was Raymond St. Jacques as cowboy Simon Blake in Rawhide's final season on CBS in 1965. And the first regular role for a black actor in a Western series was Otis Young in ABC's The Outcasts in 1968-69. In December 1991, Art Burton brought Bass Reeves' life story to the pages of True West for the first time with the cover headline story, Bass Reeves, Deputy U.S. Marshal. Under the leadership of executive editor Bob Bozbell, Art Burton's research on Bass Reeves began to be shared in True West. But it wasn't until February-March 2021 that Reeves was featured on our still controversial mashup cover of Bass Reeves as the Lone Ranger. We are grateful to Art Burton for his patience and persistence with True West, and we plan to work with the Chicago-based historian in bringing to light many more important minority men and women who helped build the West in the 19th and early 20th centuries. Article by Stuart Rosebrook. Hello, this is Michael reading True West Magazine, History of the American Frontier, May-June 2024 edition. Custer Almost Kills Curtis by Larry Lynn Peterson. The New York Herald dubbed the North American Indian, TNAI, as the most gigantic undertaking in the making of books since the King James edition of the Bible. Curtis, the West's greatest Indian photographer, had a profound effect on how whites viewed the many Native American cultures. He also instilled a sense of pride for Indians and their heritage. The final volume of TNAI was published in 1930. In the end, it required 30 years and over 40,000 photographs of 80 tribes, along with 10,000 wax cylinder recordings of indigenous languages and music to complete his mission. Each of the 20-volume sets consisted of 2,234 original photogravures. The 20 books contained a total of 1,511 photogravures, and the 20 large portfolios, a total of 723 photogravures. 2.5 million words of enlightening anthropologic text, and numerous transcriptions of language and music. It would cost over $30 million in today's money. Much of the funding would come from the House of Morgan. There is a moment in time when your dreams and history form a perfect world. For Curtis, 1907 would be that moment. An argument could be made that 1907 was the pinnacle of Curtis's life. Fresh funds from banker J.P. Morgan had not yet been spent, and the High Plains and all it promised unfolded under the big sky. Momentum for honoring the indigenous people of North America was increasing. For example, in 1907, they were celebrated on a $10 gold piece, Eagle, designed by America's finest sculptor, Augustus St. Gaudens. The obverse featured an Indian adorned in a full war bonnet. A generation earlier, that tribute would have seemed unthinkable. That same year, Charles Loomis founded the Southwest Museum of the American Indian in Los Angeles. In pursuit of Custer. The Shadow Catcher was looking ahead to his future volumes, ones on the Sioux, Cheyenne, and Crow, Upsarke in Montana and the Dakotas. Yet, as countless others before him, he became obsessed with the Custer stories, declaring, "They got into my brain, and I cannot shake it off." His first visit to the Custer battlefield, as it was known at the time, was in 1905. Curtis struck gold when he hired local legend, full-blooded Crow Alexander Upshaw, son of crazy Pen de Oriel, and his wife, Good Hair. He was born in St. Xavier, Montana, in 1874. Curtis and Upshaw probably first met in 1905 when Upshaw was Curtis's translator and organizer on his trips to Indian reservations in Montana. Having grown up on the Crow Reservation, Upshaw appeared to have his finger on the pulse of everything in southeastern Montana. Curtis immortalized him in a portrait with full headdress in Volume 4. Upshaw was a product of the Carlisle Indian Industrial School in Pennsylvania and one of William Pratt's success stories. He thrived at the school, heading up the debate team and writing articles in such publications as Red Men and Helper, where he urged Indians to travel and learn the white man's world. After graduating in 1897, he remained an advocate for the values taught at the boarding school. Upshaw became an outstanding spokesman for the Crow people. For example, in 1909, he joined Curtis on his trip to Washington, D.C., where he met President Theodore Roosevelt and discussed the difficult conditions on the Crow Reservation. Curtis' assistant, William Phillips, wrote that the local whites called Upshaw lazy, dishonest, meddlesome, here today and there tomorrow, a regular coyote, the standard description whites gave most Indians. Undaunted, Curtis placed Upshaw on the payroll in part to crack the Custer story. Dozens had been given their shot at it, but beaming with hubris, Curtis believed he would be the one to tell the true Western saga. Leaving his reputation in the hands of heavy-drinking Upshaw would prove unwise. Curtis had been obsessed over the past 3 years to find out what really happened on the battlefield. Custer was still a national hero at that time, yet it was more than a battle. It was a defining moment in American history. His goal was to form comprehensive and permanent record in his TNAI text. He was standing at ground zero for the most famous happening in the 19th century West. No other battle in American history, except Gettysburg, has had more written about it. In the 19th century, Custer was a genuine national superstar. Curtis's revelations back east would certainly fetch new subscriptions, so he thought. Ever since the battle ended in 1876, artists, photographers, and writers have added to the myth of Custer's last stand. So too have some of Custer's Crow Scouts, Curly, Goes Ahead, Half Yellow Face, Harry Moccasin, White Man Runs Him, and White Swan, who attempted to warn Custer about the size of the encampment, but to no avail. As the years passed, they would all vie for attention as they presented themselves as eyewitness experts on the battle. For a price, they delivered whatever their interviewers wanted to hear. For example, Goes Ahead told his wife, Pretty Shield, that Custer was shot and fell into the river. He, Harry Moccasin, and White Man Runs Him then fled the battle scene. In reality, Custer didn't fall into the river, and they had left well before the battle. Pretty Shield later became famous when Frank Bird Linderman wrote her biography, Red Mother, which was published in 1932. In 1931, Linderman had published the classic American The Life Story of a Great Indian, Planty Coos. Planty Coos was the chief of the Crow and one of Curtis's favorite subjects. The Scouts. Upshaw secured the services of three of Custer's Crow Scouts, Goes Ahead, Harry Moccasin, and White Man Runs Him. After leaving Custer, some had found refuge with Reno soldiers who had retreated to a safe position on the ridge. The Scouts had been paid to find the village, not to fight the Sioux. With shocking information, the three informed Curtis that Custer had passively watched from a high point on the ridge as Reno's troops were pummeled. To give credence to the idea that he held no grudge against Custer and make his fabrication more believable, White Man Runs Him insisted that Custer was always very good to us Crow Scouts and we loved him. This revelation of betrayal of Reno was just the sensational story Curtis needed to sell sets of TNAI and enhance his standing as a brilliant researcher. Curtis became convinced that the three Crow Scouts were telling the truth. Upshaw most likely thought his reputation would also be elevated nationally by this revelation. This tale could never hold muster. When attacking Indian villages, Custer went with a multi-pronged attack, charging from several directions, just like he had done in the Civil War and Washita. Robert M. Utley, in The Lance and the Shield, 1993, brought clarity to the controversy. He wrote, "From the bluff tops, he saw the village for the first time and watched Major Reno open the battle at the upper end. Then Custer led his men down a ravine that opened on Upper Medicine Tail Coulee. Benteen never showed up, but large numbers of Indian warriors did." In the most detailed account, battle expert Evan S. Connell in Son of the Morning Star, Custer and the Little Bighorn, 1984, wrote, "The last time any of the survivors saw him alive, with two or three questionable exceptions, was shortly after he turned up into the eastern hills. Reno's men in the valley saw him wave his hat, presumably to encourage them. Then he spurred his horse and rode out of sight. In reality, Custer never lingered." The three scouts had been seeking publicity ever since the battle because they felt they had never received the notoriety they deserved. Another scout, Curly Ashinshishi, for decades had gained a national reputation as the sole survivor of the Custer Massacre, a status the others envied. Curly initially reported that he watched the battle between the Sioux Cheyenne and Custer's troops from a distance. Curly, at 19 years old, claimed he stuck with Custer long after the other three scouts had fled. Soon after the battle, famed photographer D.F. Berry snapped famous portraits of Curly, adding to his celebrity. In total, over 100 photographs were taken by him by a number of photographers. Later, Curly changed the story and said that he was with Custer at the last stand and disguised himself as a Lakota warrior to escape. His family story was that after Custer fell, he hid inside a gutted horse to avoid detection. In the June 1906 Scribners, Curtis wrote, "Among the dozens of Indians I questioned of the fight of was Curly, who is so often called the sole survivor of the Custer fight. He has been so bullied, badgered, questioned, cross-questioned, leading questioned, and called by mouth and in type a coward and a liar by an endless horde of the curious and the knowledge-seeking, that I doubt today, if his life depended upon it, he could tell whether he was ever at or near the Custer fight." Loving the melodramatic, Curtis remained convinced that Custer was a coward and Reno a victim. He wrote in his notes, totaling 100 pages just on the battle, "Custer watched all of this for 45 to 60 minutes, and the whole fight was so close to him that he could have been in the thick of it in 5 minutes. In the fall of 1907, Curtis's team, including Upshaw and lead assistant William E. Myers, stayed at a cabin on the Crow reservations to finish the writing for Volume 3 and work on a separate book on the Crow and Hidaska. A fold-out map of the battle scene was included on page 44 of Volume 3. The revelation that Custer had watched Reno's retreat without intervening was first revealed to his friend, Professor Edmund S. Meany, back in Seattle. Curtis wrote, "Has there been anything published on the fact that Custer, from the highest viewpoint of the region, watched Reno's charge, battle, and defeat?" It puts an entirely new light on the entire Custer fight. Meany wrote back that he was playing with fire. Curtis defensively wrote, "This is not a pipe dream on my part. I have ridden the battlefield from end to end, back and forth, from every important point on it, noting carefully the time of such rides." Perhaps this was another exaggeration. The crash. Then events far away rocked Curtis's world. The panic of 1907 began over a three-week period in October. Stocks fell 50%, and there was a run on the banks as the world's financial system teetered on collapse. After a few months, the economy and markets slowly recovered. Curtis wrote to Charles Loomis, "Confidentially, the fact that the stock market has gone to the bow wows is making my work a bit difficult." In early 1908, Curtis returned to New York City to give Morgan's librarian, Belle de Costa Green, an update for the Titan, and to solicit new subscriptions, but with little success. The big event was Curtis publicly dropping the bombshell about Custer being a coward. Criticism was sudden and vicious and came from many corners, including Libby Custer and her supporters. Even though her husband left her in debt, Libby spent the rest of her life creating his legend in her books and defending his honor. Wounded by the furor, Curtis sought support from President Theodore Roosevelt. On April 8th, 1908, the president gave his terse response. "My dear Mr. Curtis, I have read those papers through with great interest, and after reading them, I am uncertain as to what is the best course to advise. I never heard of the three Crow Scouts that you mention, and did not know that they were with Custer. I need not say to you that writing over 30 years after an event, it is necessary to be exceedingly cautious about relying upon the memory of any man, Indian or white. Such a space of time is a great breeder of myths. Apparently, you are inclined to the theory that Custer looked on, but a short distance away, at the butchery of Reno's men, and let it take place, hoping to gain great glory for himself afterward. Such a theory is wildly improbable. Of course, human nature is so queer that it is hard to say that anything is impossible, but this theory makes Custer out to be a traitor and a fool. He would have gained just as much glory galloping down to snatch victory from defeat after Reno was so thoroughly routed. Poof. 3 years of my work on the story went up in smoke. Discouraged, Curtis wrote an army colonel, "I am beginning to believe that nothing is quite so uncertain as facts." Any mention of his theory never ended up in Volume 3. Curtis recanted and wrote Meany, "Don't have a cold chill when I say I brought in my material. I have been very guarded, and while giving a great deal of new and interesting information, I have said nothing that can be considered a criticism of Custer." He especially didn't want to upset Chief of the U.S. Forest Service Gifford Pinchot, who had just named a national forest after Custer. A sense of risky adventure always entered into Curtis's efforts, part of his melodramatic personality. Working on Volume 4, Upshaw was Curtis's tireless front man as they investigated the Absorkee Crow in southern Montana. The summer of 1908 saw Upshaw across the border in western North Dakota, building friendships with the Mandan in anticipation of release of Volume 5 about them in 1909. The next volume was released 2 years later. Reviews of the first volumes were laudatory. The Review of Reviews wrote, "The North American Indian cannot be compared with any publishing venture in the annals of American bookmaking, or indeed in those of any other nation." His friend Clinton Hart Merriman, now head of the Bureau of Biological Survey, wrote, "Every American who sees the work will be proud that so handsome a piece of bookmaking has been produced in America. And every intelligent man will rejoice that ethnology and history have been enriched by such faithful and artistic records of the aboriginal inhabitants of our country." Accolades were indeed in order. The first five volumes of TANI showcase some of Curtis's finest photogravures and text. Volume 1, 1907, The Vanishing Race, Navajo, Geronimo, Apache, The Chief of the Desert, Navajo and Canyon de Chile, Navajo. While the famous The Vanishing Race, Navajo, 1904, was picked as the first portfolio image, lesser known is its optimistic opposite, Out of the Darkness, 1904. Curtis noticed where it was shot in Tescacod Canyon, a branch of Canyon de Chelly. At the point where this picture was made, the gorge is very narrow. Volume 2, 1908, Mosa Mojave Cajatica Girl. Volume 3, 1908, In the Badlands, Prayer to the Mystery and an Oasis in the Badlands. Volume 4, 1909, The Oath, the Spirit of the Past, Absarke and Crying to the Spirits. In Volume 5, 1909, Bear's Belly, Arikara, Offering the Buffalo Skull, Mandan, and In the Medicine Lodge, Arikara. Of the Haunting the Spirit of the Past, Absaroke, 1908, Curtis wrote, a particularly striking group of old-time warriors conveying so much of the feelings of the early days of the chase and the warpath that the picture seems to reflect in an unusual degree the spirit of the past. The first two volumes were originally planned to be published at the same time in late 1907, but work on Volume 2 really delayed its release until 1908. To honor Curtis's achievement, Roosevelt invited him to the White House in February 1909. Upshaw accompanied him. A reception was held for Curtis that was attended by the President and Vice President Taft. Even though Curtis was able to convince Andrew Carnegie to finally sign up for a subscription, sales continued to be anemic. There was additional bad news later that year. Upshaw was found dead in a jail cell in Billings. He was 38 years old. Apparently, he had been drinking and was transported to jail to dry out. He died after an episode of vomiting blood in his jail cell. Some of his crow friends told Curtis that he had gotten into a fight with several white men who severely beat him. Devastated, Curtis had high praise for his friend in Volume 4. He said he was the most remarkable man he had ever met. The dean of Western historians, Robert M. Utley, who studied the battle as much as anyone, wrote, "Then on June 25, 1876, history merged with the legend to award George Armstrong Custer immortality. The Battle of the Bighorn cut short a career that would have gained occasional mention in the histories of the Civil War and the Western frontier. Instead, it made the slain Custer's name a household word then and forever after, an icon in the public imagination, at times bright, at times tarnished, but never in danger of decay." The reflective Utley wrote, "The simplest answer, usually overlooked, is that the army lost largely because the Indians won. To ascribe defeat entirely to military failing is to devalue Indian strength and leadership." And Custer almost cut short Curtis's career. "Custer Almost Kills Curtis" is excerpted from Western American art historian Dr. Larry Lynn Peterson's latest book, Edward S. Curtis, Printing the Legends, Looking at Shadows in a West Lit Only by Fire. The award-winning author lives with his wife, Leanne, on the Spirit of Winter Ranch near Sisters, Oregon, in the shadows of the Three Sisters Mountains, Hope, Faith, and Charity. True West, November 2022 edition. Coors Beer and Candy? By Sherry Monahan. When Adolf Coors decided to start his brewery, he partnered with a fellow German named Jacob Schuller in 1873. Coors ran the brewery while Schuller kept making his confections and baking. He later went on to open a soda water business. Their partnership ended in 1880 when Coors bought out Schuller and became the sole owner of the brewery. Around that time, Schuller moved to Manitou to operate his soda and mineral water business. By mid-1881, the Golden Brewery had made many improvements by adding new machinery, erecting a bottling and packing plant, and two ice houses in Golden while maintaining offices in Denver. Most of their beer was bottled and shipped for sale in Colorado and 10 other western states. The average output was about 1,000 gallons per day, and they produced $40,000 worth of the amber fluid in 1881. Their beer had gained popularity, and in 1887, farmers gathered in Golden to have a market day, and Coors supplied the beer. The newspaper noted, "Another thing, the beer drank was the famous Golden Brewery, which makes beer equal, and by some considered superior, to Budweiser." In 1899, Coors introduced a special brew called Salvatore Select. According to the Denver Post, it was brewed according to the process employed and the manufacturing of the Salvator beer of Munich. Identically, the same material is used, and the product invites comparison with the original. This brand is only sold in bottles and will be found in first-class saloons, hotels, cafes, and clubs. Select Salvator cost $1.20 for 24 pint bottles. Drinking too much caused many a pioneer to stumble and get into trouble. Julius Schwab was one of them. He was a foreman at Coors in 1900 and was inebriated beyond control when he tried to cross a swing bridge near Clear Creek. The Lee Footbridge proved too much for him, and he lost his balance and fell in. 7 years later, after attending a nearby German picnic, Coors employee George Didel was feared to be dead after crossing the same bridge. In addition to beer, Coors made a malt extract, and in 1904 advertised the health benefits of it. In part, the ad read, "The malt that makes you strong. Of course you know what early summer weather is going to do to you, unless your general condition be wholly right. There's no way on earth to make it right so quickly as the 100% malt extract provides. Digestive organs, muscles, nerves, brains all respond to the dynamo of health and strength that's enchained in Coors Golden Malt Extract, made in Coors Golden Brewery, a mile and more above sea level." By 1908, Coors was producing 90,000 barrels of beer annually. In 1916, when Prohibition forced Coors to dump its beer, Adolph started a porcelain factory and also began making Manna non-alcoholic beer, malted milk, and beefed up his malt extract production to survive. The company recommended that people drink Manna because it was a good build-up for the sick and very good for those convalescing. It advertised, "For a cool, refreshing, thirst-quenching beverage for the summer, men will find it steadying and pleasant. Coors Manna is the best of the non-alcoholic beer and far ahead of the dark-colored malt extracts with their large alcohol contents. They suggested the unfermented extract because it was healthful, invigorating, and non-intoxicating. It has all the good qualities of lager and only a trace of alcohol." The milk, a powder-based product made of malted barley and wheat, was promoted as an alternative to mother's milk, an infant supplement. When Prohibition was repealed in 1933, Coors began shipping beer again, but continued making the milk until the 1950s. Coors offered this recipe in 1920 and suggested it be sprinkled on ice cream, breakfast foods, or anything else as a sugar substitute. Malted milk drink. 1 cup cold milk or water. 1/4 cup malted milk powder. Sweet cocoa powder, sweet shaved chocolate, cinnamon, nutmeg, vanilla, etc. optional. Combine the milk, powder, and flavoring of your choice. The original recipe suggested you put it in a bowl and whip it with an egg beater, non-motorized hand mixer, or lemonade shaker to blend. Feel free to use a blender or other means to blend it together. Serve cold or warmed over low heat. Recipe adapted from the Denver Press, January 8, 1920.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.